This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballerman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballerman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 44. And I'm delighted to be joined on the show today by Alex Langridge, director of the Up Group, to talk about the very hot topic of whether fintechs can grow up without, as it were, turning into their parents. Less metaphorically, taking alternative finance, will it remain alternative, or will it end up like a Moorish house, inward looking into its own courtyard? Will they become like banks with levels and levels of internal committees, office politics, policies, and a lack of focus? Will this happen across fintech as a whole? It seems to me there are two key factors here. Firstly, the firm has to decide what its culture is. Which parts of that were just startup land? For many clients or business-facing fintechs, for example, suits are already de rigueur and t-shirts were just startup. Which parts do they want to keep? Beanbags? Ping pong tables? Secondly, who do you recruit? It's a good gossip topic over drinks for insiders in the UK fintech scene to discuss the obvious don't fits. The imported investment bankers oozing arrogance and entitlement stick out like a sore thumb. Quite in contrast to real fintechers who, having grown from nowhere, know that they have been lucky to survive a perilous path that most of their compatriots have fallen off. And there, but for the grace of God, went they. It's at this nexus that the role of a professional search firm, aka headhunters, is key. The Up Group was formed in 2007 with a vision to become the primary destination for digital talent. They must be doing well given the number of gigs they've worked on in the fintech scene with some of the leading players. For example, Zopa, Market Invoice, WorldRemit, and Cantox, just to mention four that have been on the podcast already. I'm delighted to be joined by someone who has placed key hires into fintech land and faces these challenges daily. So, let's dive into the topic of can you grow up without growing old? Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi Alex, thanks for joining me today.
Mike, thanks for coming up here to Millbank Tower to share one of the finest views of London and, more importantly, to chew the cud on what talent in fintech does and doesn't mean.
Indeed, and thank you for inviting me on a sunny day, and I think it's the tallest view of London I've got from the furthest west, as it were, and wherever I view London from high towers, having spent a lot of my life in them, I'm always amazed by how much the Thames does bend up and down. Now, we were talking about bending rivers. We were talking about China before, and China is certainly doing a lot in alternative finance and fintech, and a lot of those have got sort of multi-billion dollar frauds, or a lot of them. Some of them have got multi-billion dollar frauds, and it's all very exciting. And you were telling me that you were an expert on Anglo-Chinese relations yourself.
Yes, married a Chinese lady a number of years ago now. I soon found out in my cultural integration into Chinese culture that you should never just assume that a porcelain figurine is merely that. Actually, these things are actually quite sacred to people such as mother-in-laws. And having placed the ironing board slightly too near to the Kuan Yin, the goddess of mercy, actually, that was almost about to start the fourth Anglo-Chinese war.
Oh dear. Well, I know a little bit about the Chinese stuff myself, because in my alternative incarnation, I'm a Qigong instructor, and my Qigong teacher was also a proper feng shui consultant, not one of these sort of Westerners that says, get a goldfish and a mirror. And indeed, China is a very different culture, and it's not just different in the way that people think of it as different. I mean, India is different from us, but India is still Indo-Aryan. So if you look at Indian philosophy, for example, they have a pretty similar approach to the West in terms of it's very linguistic, albeit they've got the concept of emptiness. Once you go north of the Himalayas, then Chinese philosophy, by and large, or in general, is always rather existential and expressed in poetic terms. So, for example, the Tao Te Ching, which we'll know as the primary text of philosophical Taoism, is extremely poetical and includes a bunch of characters which are only ever seen once in that. So it's impossible to have the definitive translation of the Tao Te Ching, which has kept publishers going for a long time. So it's very different.
Yes, well, I have to say that as exotic as your experiences have been, that's probably what Many of my former colleagues were looking on me back in 2009 when I started banging the drum for fintech.
Something far away and obscure.
Absolutely. Real frontier land back in the days of partners turning around to me and saying, "Fin, what the hell, what, Alex? What are you doing?" And since then, I've bubbled along with it, been riding the wave of hype, which has come through London, but fortunately, and according to many of my clients, actually adding some real value to some maturing and professionalizing firms. And isn't it nice in this sauna of hype that we've had over the last year, as many people have discovered what fintech is and isn't, that there are people, there are people out there who are genuinely following, tracking, taking this extremely seriously and getting to know these clients from the inside.
Yes, I mean, in terms of what fintech is, I think we're slowly narrowing down. I mean, fintech last year got into a very airy cappuccino. I was talking to somebody about this morning over a very still coffee. And now some of the bubbles are actually bursting in terms of perceptions and hype and frankly just bullshit. And I don't think yet we're getting anywhere near a macchiato, which is the sort of thing I always have in mind for this podcast. But I think we're getting nearer a latte. The sort of some of the bubbles are dropping out of the cappuccino. But I mean, just finishing off on your journey, you did what Oxford quaintly calls modern languages, and I'm all in favour of diversity, so it's nice occasionally to have someone from Oxford on the show. I think you were only the second after Giles. Clearly such a staid old university as that, people don't in general do many exciting things. But you did modern languages there, otherwise known as languages. And then you sort of touched on tax and all sorts of things like that. So what was your journey? I mean, you obviously in 2009 got with it, but how did you know about fintech and how did it all come about?
My personal time in tax lasted a mere 7 months, as my boredom threshold wasn't high enough to keep me there. And the move into headhunting coincided with one of the biggest capital markets booms in history, which was all very good fun for the couple of years.
Which year was that then about?
2005. Yeah, that was great fun whilst it lasted. When 2007 and 8 hit, the geeky, introverted side of me, which had been reading everything in The Economist for many years, actually decided, well, hang on, there's this thing called the technology industry, and it's actually coming at financial services in a far, far greater way than anybody realises. So why don't I go and reinvent myself? And so, having waved the flag for fintech, it's one of the largest search firms in the world, and having had some fun playing around with exchanges, clearing houses, large technology vendors, was actually flattered to be approached by the Up Group back in 2013, when I could see that their vast network of B2C and more consumer-driven and digital, dare I say it, technology talent in general, was going to play into the world of financial services as I then knew it.
Yes, I think vocabulary is very important, and I entirely agree with this sort of digital world. I mean, it's much more useful, I feel, to see this all as the impact of digital on financial services. And clearly, you're ahead of your time in terms of seeing that. I mean, it's been a bit of a mystery, perhaps, why it's taken 20 years to get there. Although 20 years ago, roughly, probably, I opened a bank account with Intelligent Finance, which at the time in the UK was the first online-only bank. And people said, "Oh, this is far too dangerous, far too risky," and yada yada yada. And it's still there now. So moving on to the main course of the meal, main course of the podcast today. Fintechs, in terms of firms who call themselves fintechs for the sake of argument, go from a whole range of shapes and sizes. In the autumn, I was talking to Alexander Gaillard of InvestGlass, and he's got roughly off the top of my head about a handful. Last week's episode, I was with Rosbeth Batcher of City Falcon, and they've got a sort of a dozen plus. And then I guess one goes to the largest firms and funding circles, and that was sort of 200 plus plus, and that kind of number. So just in terms of topology, the type of firms that you can be working with range enormously. So maybe we can look at the journey from being, a very small fintech as you're scaling up. And then in terms of talking about how they scale up, how they can avoid this scaling up without turning into the thing that they opposed in the very first place and just becoming some boring kind of non-bank bank, as it were. So logically speaking, and in terms of what I know, people at the very small end recruit their mates or people they can find. Presumably that works as well as it works for a while, and then eventually starts working less and less well. And then people start to think of dreaded things like headhunters or professionalizing it. And, they presumably start by doing that badly. And presumably you have to start by educating them. But you tell me about the journey from an actual, not the theory perspective or the secondhand perspective I'm talking about, but actually from somebody who helps people at the coalface.
Thank you, Mike. Yeah, that's you raised it, some absolutely great points there. And I think that's that move away from using friends and contacts is often a very emotional one. It's a tough one in many ways because you have to think of yourself as a very different type of organization, and actually putting in those building blocks internally of how you're going to brand yourself and think about yourself, how you're going to persuade people of the market opportunity. In many cases, you are a first-time entrepreneur. You are that CEO for the first time. You don't have that track record. We're building everything up from scratch. So the quality of your investors, the quality of the existing team, the market size, and the personal commitment is absolutely integral. The internal alignment, and this is something that's that firms will go through an enormous journey on, is defining what is your culture, what are the values, assumptions, behaviors, and skills which people need to be successful in your business. So firstly, how do you define it? Are you really recognizing that? And then thirdly, do you have people who are trained and smart interviewers who are can actually dig down into exactly what somebody has done and what makes for a great CV?
Yes, I mean, just sticking with the culture, because that's the sort of the bit that I'm certainly fascinated with at the moment. And in LFP 042, my New Year's special, I was talking about indie/rebel versus the establishment in Star Wars and in the beer market, as well as in fintech. And let's just take some leading players in terms of, for example, peer-to-peers. They're the most prominent and well-known by people in general, sort of Zopam, Market Invoice, Funding Circle, and say RateSetter. Knowing those firms, I could probably sit down and have a little guess about their cultures and kind of what they're going for, but actually I probably couldn't do it that well. And I'm interested in terms of how you found that people define their cultures, or how you help them to define their culture. I mean, let's say for the sake of argument, in a year's time, this ain't going to happen. The London FinTech podcast is a dozen strong, and I've needed to bring people on board and integrate them into the culture of London FinTech podcast. How do people actually do that? Because as you say, at the beginning, it's implicit, yeah? Like Funding Circle, three mates got together. Well, of course, they know each other. And they know their kind of dynamics and what films they like and what food they like and, all these kind of stuff. And how do people start making what's implicit explicit?
No, it's a process that we go through with them extensively about talking about what made them make various choices about becoming the firm that they were going to become, who the people who were successful, whom they hired, why they hired them, educational backgrounds, attitude. And just talking to them about, how do you do your business? Is this all about finding people who are just passionate about testing and learning and quickly getting to the answer? Or do you have a very strong culture of expertise in someone like World Remit? You have one of the world's leading remittances experts in the form of Ismail Ahmed at the top of the organization, who's very bothered about regulation compliance, and he's made that a great USP. So it's clear that when you have people at the top who have come from a tech or a fin background, there are actually some things that you can divine and deduce from their professional backgrounds as well.
Yes, and once you're getting to a certain scale, there's a challenge, which of course all large organizations see, in that once you've got a certain number of people, it's not a group of people, if you know what I mean. So, past certain number N, where N is unknown, you stop being a firm and you start being a collection of divisions, departments or whatever. And, those are the sort of audit and tax people over there, and those are the credit people over there, and those are the salesmen over there. And actually, there may be, and hopefully is, a group culture theme throughout. But actually, there's quite a difference between tech people who spend their entire day looking into a computer and salespeople who go out and have lots of drinks or, that kind of stuff. So also you've got the subcultures within the dominant culture as well.
No, I think that's very fair. And when firms, dare I say it, start to grow up in inverted commas, invariably the desire by founders and investors to keep on growing, keep on pushing, means that everybody's incredibly focused on building up practices and processes that make these businesses scalable. So the importance of a very strong chief people officer. And for those of you who have come from more traditional institutions, this is very much a chief people officer. This is not a HR officer.
I like the CPO thing. I've never heard of that before. And I like the CPO thing, as I said before on the podcast, when I started in the city quite some time ago, the word was personnel, and that came from the army. And by and large, in the army, you want to look after your troops because they're the ones who are going to save you from getting killed. Over time, it quotes professionalized into human resources, but the name is such an awful, awful name. You've just turned people into resources rather than, you know, personnel. So I'm glad that actually people is coming back as a phrase.
No, very much so. And yeah, I think we owe a lot to the influence of some pretty smart people and smart, thoughtful people, leaders in the Valley, who actually want far more of that Netflix-style culture in fintech. Yeah, the process of getting from sort of being a collection of mates where everybody is the CEO, i.e. the chief everything officer,
good one.
Into professionalization is a fascinating and unique one for every firm. And there are common themes, however, because invariably we are called on to hire. The first big hire that makes a difference after somebody's received a nice splodge of Series A is either a CTO, a CMO, a CCO, maybe a CFO. And you know, there are some very common themes in what we're asked to go out and find, and the realities of what those talent pools look like, and where these people are going to come from.
Yes, it's interesting actually, because one of the things that I hadn't particularly joined the dots with in my own mind, which I'm now thinking, given how you describe it, is that a fintech, a startup, starts with, as you say, chief everything officers and doing things in, going back to Chinese culture, doing things in a Taoist way, like water flowing around. And then the problem can arise that when they think they are getting more structured, which they do need to be, the problem can then be you end up being too Confucian. It's too rigid, you know, you're number two son and number three daughter, and you know, it's all kind of defined. And apart from the CPO, which I quite like, one of the challenges is that things like CTOs, CMOs, CCOs, chief credit officers, these are phrases taken right out of the banking textbook. And before you know it, you start to take your culture, your firm, and you start to squash it into a very, very conventional organogram. And of course, before you know it, a bit like putting your foot into a sort of certain type of shoe, your foot ends up adapting to the shoe rather than vice versa. So I think the organogrammitis and this sort of Taoism versus Confucianism is an interesting thing. And I've actually never really heard of people doing much about it in the fintech scene. I mean, obviously, in the tech scene in general, they've got all sorts of silly titles, you know, chief crazy guy and, you know, chief disruptor of disruption and, you know, yardy yardy. But actually, a lot of the fintechs say are adopting this kind of language, aren't they?
Well, actually, I quite like the title head of fun, which they have at Just Eat.
But this is my point. Techs do that quite well. They go, bollocks, we're not having these stupid, boring old fart titles. We're going to come up with something new and sexy. But I haven't, off the top of my head, actually ever taken a fintech business card from a solid fintech that's got a stupid title on. Sorry, stupid is the wrong word, but you know what I mean, a non-conventional title.
Yeah, I think that is very fair. And yeah, I think that to your point about culture, I would add the point about mission and being true to, you know, what your mission is and who you're going to become when you grow up. And so if we do sort of critically but, you know, fairly analyse some of the so-called challenger banks, I mean, they have turned into mini versions of their parents very, very quickly, and the shorts have gone off and the trousers and proper shirts have come on. Looking at the fintechs, ultimately, I don't think we can expect there to be the same culture as, you know, other parts of the tech world. Ultimately, the founders, with very noble ambitions to reform finance, to make the world transparent and safe, and prevent, you know, our children having to bail out the banks, as happened 8 years ago, there is a huge amount of value in, you know, those people thinking in terms of safety, security, risk management. And that does bring in a different culture. You know, you just cannot bring in a CTO from an advertising technology business or somebody from Facebook where it's all about moving fast and breaking things. Well,
absolutely.
Mike, please don't break my banking app.
No, absolutely. Well, this is something I've been banging on for a long time, as you know, as you've been unfortunate to listen to the podcast yourself, that fintech isn't tech, because people don't like their money disappearing due to some sort of software failure, which is like HSBC and RBS find when their computer systems crash all the time. Well, I think that, you know, just to try and wrap up this thing on the culture point, of course, you know, you've got a dynamic tension or a dialectic, if you like, between, in Asian terms, form and emptiness, between rigidity and flow. On the one hand, when you're growing up as a firm, by definition, you're becoming more structured. On the other hand, if you just become too structured, you're ossified, and you've lost that flow, that flexibility, the informality that you had when you're younger, and each particular fintech is going to, as it were, grow with a different ratio, maybe 70% structured, 30% flow, or 70% flow, 30% structured. And I'm very, very conscious of something I've been banging on about for over a year. On the risk side, and just picking up the CCO, absolutely you need a credit officer in almost all of these fintechs. But as I was talking to one of the leading players in fintech land this morning about, this misses out a CRO, a chief risk officer, in my terms, which is very old-fashioned terms, before the world got divided into tiny mosaics defined by regulation and everyone was looking at just a tiny tile. So in my day, in the 90s, when I was coping with Clark Benson going from 2,500 to 5, from 5,000 to 50,000 and addressing these challenges in a large organisation, the CRO's mission there was to ensure that the chairman and CEO of the bank, when they woke up at 4 o'clock in the morning, weren't worried about something. If they were, he would pick that up. Going back to the flexibility of agenda, you know, now that's a very, very different role from the essential role, which is to make sure that a P2P, for example, only lends to quotes good credits, you know, and that's somewhat missed. So we discussed the culture, we discussed the organogram kind of thing. And then one of the other things that presumably you must spend your time doing is that, as in most cases where people haven't used agents before, whether they're estate agents, lawyers, or search funds, one of your first tasks is to educate them as to how to use the agents successfully. So I come to you and say, oh, Alex, I hear you're something in fintech land, and I want someone for my show, and I want a good person, you know? And as you've explained, you helped me define what it is that I mean by good. But what's involved in kind of training people who haven't used professional search firms before to use them effectively for them and also for you, of course?
I think a lot of it starts with honesty about your expectations, about what should be delivered. You know, you should expect a search firm who will, you know, on a critical hire, push back on you and actually say, can you define this role better? Actually, the number of times that we received five-legged purple unicorn type of role specs is quite amusing. And so it's far better to, you know, to have that frank conversation up front. Expect the agent, as you charmingly put it, to come up with a very, very clear set of processes whereby they are going to deliver you with the right candidates to show that they've done their due diligence with referencing, with report taking, with really thorough interviewing. And conversely, you should expect them to ask of you that you would have thoroughly thought through your interviewing process and you would be thinking of the candidate experience at all times, and what's going to differentiate you in this white hot talent hiring market to anybody else is the amount of time that you are prepared as founders with them, and when it comes to the end of the process, on your alignment with the investors and what the investors think of you, and how the investors are going to be selling exactly the same story as yourself. And putting this all together, that does create a very differentiated talent acquisition model.
No, absolutely. That's very eloquently and clearly explained. And hearing you say that, I just sort of think that people who haven't used this kind of process before perhaps don't appreciate enough how much basically, quotes, free consultancy, unquotes, comes from the likes of a search firm in terms of helping the firm, whether it's a tech or fintech or any other firm, actually get their whole act together and do the whole thing professionally. You know, let's say that a firm ends up interviewing half a dozen or 10 people. Actually, that is a marketing opportunity to each of them. It's only going to take one of them, but it doesn't want to take one and upset the other nine by having treated them poorly or unprofessionally. You know, you never know what goes around and comes around. And one of the challenges in terms of professionalising markets that have been illiquid, so we will say that fintech recruitment has been an illiquid market, a small number of transactions historically, and you know it's now growing, is that it's quite hard to define a price in illiquid markets. You know, once you're trying to recruit, shall we say, a junior FX trader for Citigroup, it's a well-known market, there's lots of them, and you can say, actually, we've surveyed a million salaries, and the average salary is this, and bonus is that, and da-da-da-da-da. So how is the whole remuneration thing approached? I think I did read a very good survey on your website, and is it getting easier over time to actually come up with objective benchmarks, which is say, okay, look, Mike, you've got a job here, and they're offering this, and this is the market, rather than this is a random sum of money. Let's talk about random sums of money instead, you know.
Great question. The answer is yes and no.
Like all great questions, the answer is always yes and no.
So yes, in terms of the maturation of this ecosystem, salaries, compensation levels are becoming better and better known. And to your point about benchmarking, it's very important that you should think of yourselves not just in terms of what other fintechs are paying, but what the rest of the digital economy is paying for these people and what people in the banks are being paid for, the the specialist technical banking skill sets. The answer is no, because we are well aware that given we're creating some category leaders in London for global fintech, for which, despite all the hype, we should all be very proud of, that people at the very top and the three best people in the market at the best known brands are the ones we are always asked to find, are seeing massive inflationary pressures on their packages. So for a Series A business to actually pay that person's salary plus a bonus and the stock options is going to be unrealistic. So your compensation has to be tied up very quickly with a whole discussion about what you're hiring for. If you've only got a C-grade budget, don't expect your search firm to hire you an A-grade player. Think about where you can compromise. Think about what the role really needs. And so at the very top end, expect to be shocked.
Yes. Well, that seems quite a good summary. And again, that's part of the whole transition process of organisations, which is that the people that start it with a sense of adventure and a love of it, you know? And I know more than one CEO who's not paying himself to get beyond whatever the next gap they need to get beyond. And that's a great difference from when you're hiring someone from the FSA to sort of sit there ticking boxes on the regulatory compliance and all that kind of stuff. They're not necessarily there for the love and passion of changing the world's approach to foreign exchange. They're there to actually make sure the regulator's happy and tick the boxes, or the same in audit, or all of those kind of roles. So just wrapping up this main course on hiring and culture and all this kind of stuff. Obviously, fintech is a relatively limited market. So if you want to recruit someone into your fintech from another fintech, that's a fairly small pool. So by and large, recruitment tends to come either from other techs or other firms completely, or other digitals, or more recently, as I mentioned sarcastically in the introduction, from investment banks. So how do you go about approaching sort of lateral talent, or whatever the phrase might be?
So, you know, lateral talent is in fact the main talent pool for many of these fintechs. And so, you know, when a best-in-class B2B FX player such as Cantox wants to go to the market and actually professionalise its entire sales marketing organisation, actually going to the historic FX brokerage world is very unlikely to be the answer. In fact, I know it wasn't for them. You know, we did a Europe-wide search, you know, trying to find somebody from a software as a service background where they had seen that entire customer journey. And so somebody who has been through that process, we actually found an outstanding candidate who had been through that process of being in several SaaS startups, being acquired by larger businesses, having seen blue chip best practice culture, and ways of processes and ways of doing things, at the same time still had that drive and desire to work in somewhere small and make his mark. That type of lateral talent is actually rare but exceptionally valuable for fintechs.
Absolutely, I can see that. And again, in terms of what fintechs can take away from this, listening to you, Alex, they get a good sense of actually that, like most icebergs, most of it's below the water in terms of what makes a good search firm. Moving on to Upgroup, per se, I say you've been very successful, and just in terms of asking around the fintech scene as a whole, I mentioned P2P and finance as examples, but actually this applies fintech-wise. There are very few players, and your reputation, and it's judged by the client list that you mentioned earlier, a subset of the client list, is extremely good. So where's Upgroup going from now?
For the Upgroup, we would see digital transformation and digital growth as being very much two different sides of the same coin. So we're as proud, this may be a heresy for many of your listeners, Mike.
My listeners like heresies. If they don't like heresies, they turn over to another podcast fairly soon.
Good, you can burn me at the stake later. So we are very proud to have worked for Credit Suisse Private Bank and for Aviva and Travelex on their digital transformations, people who are at the forefront. And I think it's great to be part of an economy which is actually just making things better for the consumer at the end of the day. No matter, some fintechs will fail, some will succeed, but what is really, really important is they are putting such pressure on the incumbent players that the banks have shown no sign of pulling back from their investments in fintech. And so, for us to actually be part of placing the right talent in the right organisation at its life stage is incredibly fulfilling.
So like all agents, you always quite like more business. So whether you're an estate agent, a solicitor or a search firm, you quite like people calling you with mandates. And I think that people can work out that themselves. On the candidate side, because at one level, whatever we're doing, we're all potential candidates for our next role and the next call. What kind of people are you after? And equally, what kind of people are you not after? Because what I don't want to happen as a result of this is that you receive 2,000 emails saying, oh, I'm a garden designer in Kazakhstan, and can you put me on my list, and can you have a coffee? I mean, myself, I gave up last year having coffees because I didn't mind if people paid me sort of $500 for a coffee. I could actually live on it. Otherwise, I spend my entire week drinking coffee. I wasn't sleeping whatsoever. I had about one spare minute to try and do some consultancy stuff. So I don't want your inbox to fill with 2,000 emails, Alex, but what kind of people are you interested in hearing about?
Thank you. Look, we have particular expertise in helping growing firms. So anybody who's thinking of about to raise, you know, a very good seed and series A rounds, going right up to established financial services organizations, we would see ourselves as the first port of call once you've exhausted your personal network. Secondarily, I'm always very happy to have a conversation with senior established individuals from across the digital world and indeed the financial services world, where there is genuine interest and affinity with the values of many fintechs.
Good. So thank you for that. The time has gone by very fast as always, and that's really very clear. And from my experience putting things into the agency context, a good lawyer can really help out your business, and a bad lawyer can be causing holes in the ship. And the same thing applies in the search firms. And there's nothing more intimate than finding a new partner for yourself or new partners and people in your business. And it's something that people really need to do extremely well. And as I mentioned before, without mentioning names, I was sitting next to a very senior chap at breakfast this morning who recommended the Up Group highly. So clearly what you guys are doing is working out very well, and I hope that continues long into the future.
We like to think so. We're never complacent, and we will continue to dedicate ourselves to this space.
Great. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app, or sign up at londonfintechpodcast.com for email alerts and new episodes. Live long and prosper.
Could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. Come away from the city, but with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so gray, with the pain of the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. City goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight dance.